In today's episode, we interview Camille Londet, Professor of Economics at the LSE. He is Director of the Stuyvesant Research Centre at the LSE and Co-Director of the Public Economics Programme, as well as of the Hub for Equal Representation in the Economy. Professor Londet has done extensive research into the child penalty, or the full dynamic impact of having a child on the careers of men and women, and its contribution to gender inequality in different countries. He has also examined whether family policies such as parental leave and childcare have been effective in reducing this inequality. More recently, he has written about inheritance tax reform, arguing that whilst there is a strong case to be made for inheritance taxation from both an economic and normative standpoint, the tax systems of most Western economies are failing to bring about a more equitable society. So thank you for being on our podcast. We're very grateful to have you here. You have done extensive research into the child penalty, the negative causal effect of having children on the labour market, outcomes of women relative to men. To start, we would love to hear what motivated your research into the topic.
I'd say that, like all great research questions, you start getting motivated by them through personal experiences. And what really triggered my interest in those topics, I mean, during my PhD, I was interested in family economics and things like this, but the research into child penalties really came about when my wife and I had kids, and we realized that there were a lot of things that we were doing that didn't seem to respond much to any form of rational economic thinking. I got kind of really interested into understanding better why we were doing the things we were doing at the time. And that triggered that big research agenda that I've been researching ever since.
Thank you for sharing that. Could you give our listeners an outline of the approach you and your colleagues developed in order to quantify the penalty and the main qualitative patterns you observe in your results?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So I think what we do is actually dead simple. We just started by trying to get the best longitudinal data that you can get. So following the exact same people over time, and then trying to look at both fathers and mothers and at how their outcomes in the labor market, so typically labor force participation, earnings, and so on and so forth, varied just around the time where both of them had their first kid. And it seems relatively stupid to do, but the reason that hadn't been done before, I think it's just one, lack of data. The availability of such great longitudinal panel data is actually quite recent. So that's one. The second is that there was some form of obsession, I'd say, among economists to trying to find what we call instruments. So basically, there is this understanding that, of course, the arrival of kids, it's not random. It's a choice, and the fact of having kids, therefore, can of course be attributed to a lot of decisions that people actively make. And in that respect, therefore, what people thought is that just looking at what happened around the arrival of kids would not really identify the causal effect of kids, because it could also be triggered by all the other things that make people want to have kids at that time. And I think that's a generally fair point. The problem is that actually the extent of the specialization that happens between men and women at the moment they have kids is just so strong that actually you already see just in the raw data, by just doing that very simple descriptive evidence, just how strong that specialization is.
Fantastic, thank you. And you have recently built a world atlas of child penalties in employment based on data from 134 countries. How does the relative contribution of the child penalty to overall gender equality, inequality and the gender pay gap appear to change over the course of development?
So that's a great question. I think, indeed, what we tried to do with this atlas was to have a such a great number of estimates of the child penalty across very different countries that are therefore very different in terms of their context, in terms of economic development, that we could start to get a better sense of how child penalties and economic development interrelate. And what we see from these maps, from this exercise, is actually extremely striking. The first thing we see is that there is actually an inverted U shape of overall gender inequality over the course of development. When you look at labor market outcomes, such as employment, for instance, at very low level of development, there is actually much less inequality in terms of employment rates of men and women compared to what you find at middle income level of development. So again, to give a sense of context, what is very low income level of development? We're talking about countries in sub-Saharan Africa, such as Burundi, for instance, or Uganda, very, very low level of development. Middle income countries, we're going to talk about level of income per capita of in between, you know, $8,000 per year to $10,000 per year. It's countries such as some of the BRICS, for instance, okay, Brazil or China. And then very high level of development, it's going to be countries such as countries in Europe, for instance, the UK, France, Germany. And so what we're seeing is that there is this increase in gender inequality from very low level of development to middle income level of development. But then there is a decline again. Sorry about that.
Don't worry.
There is a decline as we go from middle income level to high income level. Now, what's really interesting is that we can really attribute a lot of the increase in the size of gender inequality between the low level of development and middle income level to the rise of child penalty and family penalties. So at very low level of development, there is no such thing as a child penalty. Men and women don't change drastically the type of things they do at the moment kids arrive. That really happens when we reach middle income level. And then what's interesting is that that high kind of level of child penalty and family penalties actually don't disappear, meaning that most of the gains that we're having in terms of gender inequality between middle income level and high level of development is due to other things than the child penalty. It's because women start getting a high level of education, oftentimes higher level of education than men. They start getting the same occupation and so on and so forth. Okay, so what's interesting is it tells us that the importance of child penalty in understanding gender inequality is actually relatively recent in the overall course of human development.
It's really interesting to hear sort of the transition over that inverted U-shaped curve. And a key statistic that stood out to us is that Scandinavian countries feature long-run penalties of 21 to 26%, while German-speaking countries feature penalties as high as 51 to 60%. So what do you believe is the most crucial factor in explaining such variation between countries with similar levels of development, and how should public policy respond?
Mm-hmm. So I think what we've just described is over the course of development. But what's really interesting is that even within the same level of development, so take European countries, for instance, today, there is still massive amount of heterogeneity in terms of the size of penalties. As you mentioned, we have countries like Scandinavian countries that are actually relatively equal and where the long-run penalties is not that high, and countries such as German-speaking countries that are literally like next door and that share many cultural institutions, so on and so forth, with Scandinavian countries, and still at the same level of development exhibit twice as large a child penalty. Where can that come from? Well, you know, it's not due to the level of economic development, so there must be something else. What's actually very, very striking is that when you do a simple correlation of the level of the child penalty with indicators of elicited norms, gender norms, okay, such as, oh, the fraction of the population that agrees with the statement that a child will suffer if his or her mother works when they are less than 5 years old, for instance. The level of correlation between this and the child penalty is extremely strong at the same level of development. So clearly there is a sense that what seemed to really matter is a set of beliefs and norms about what men and women should do at the moment they have kids, okay? That of course interact with a lot of other cultural institutions and economic institutions. But clearly it seems like what we need to understand is where those norms come from, how they get formed, how they get created, because it seems that this is really something that correlates extremely strongly and that must be at the heart of the massive heterogeneity that we're seeing in child penalties.
Fantastic, thank you so much. And there have been large expansions of family policies over the last 60 years, and their impact on gender pay gaps is hotly debated. You investigated the joint impact of parental leave and childcare in Austria. How effective were these policies?
So I'm not going to lie, that work has been utterly disappointing in its finding, the quality of the work. I think it's great work, and but what we found is when you look at a country like Austria, that over the course of 60 years put in place extremely generous parental leave policies, that also expanded massively its childcare access, and in particular by making childcare extremely affordable, and try to expand access to childcare across the Austrian geography. All of these, in fine, had an absolutely marginal impact on the overall evolution of gender inequality. How can that be? Well, I think there are a set of obvious answers to this. First, it's not that, for instance, when you put childcare in place, it's not effective in actually getting children to childcare. The kids go to childcare. But what has really fascinated us is the fact that even though the kids got into childcare, the moms would not take that opportunity to actually go back to the labor market. And how can that be? Well, again, what we found is that that had a lot to do with extremely strong gender norms that make it extremely stigmatizing for women to actually take up a job when they have young kids. So, of course, there's going to take this cheap opportunity to get childcare, but that means that, yeah, even though they are taking this opportunity, it's going to be too costly for them to just go back to the labor market. And therefore, what that tells us is that if we really want to think about making a dent in child penalties, we need to go beyond marginal policy reforms such as expanding childcare and stuff like that. We need to really address what is at the heart of the formation of these extremely gender-biased norms with respect to what men and women should be doing when kids arrive.
Fantastic. So that's very interesting. It sounds like there's some form of non-compliance there from, I guess, driven by beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Now pivoting to a very different topic, inherited wealth is once more becoming a key driver of wealth inequality, and is the most important determinant of one's ability to reach the top of the wealth distribution. You argue that inheritance tax, or the inheritance tax systems of most Western economies, are failing to bring about more equitable societies, and you therefore propose four guiding principles for reform of the system. Could you explain to our listeners what these four principles are and the rationale behind them?
Mm-hmm. Of course. So what's important to maybe remind your listeners of is just that inheritance taxation or estate taxation is one of the oldest form of taxation. It's been around for quite a lot of time, and it's also historically one of the earliest form of progressive taxation. That being said, I think the system is in disarray in pretty much any advanced economy, and that's why we thought it was important to try to understand where that came from. The basic principles are relatively simple. The first one is that when you are taxing inheritances, what you actually care about is what? Well, you care about unequal opportunities in terms of everything that you're going to receive just from the point of view of having been born in a specific family. And in that respect, what really therefore determines the opportunities that have been given to you by the fact of being in that particular family is the overall flows of inheritances that you're going to receive throughout your lifetime. Okay, in general, you do not receive inheritance just once. Most big or very wealthy families basically do a lot of estate planning, and they're going to essentially receive some wealth transmission throughout their lifetime. So what we care about in determining basically the opportunities that you get is just the overflows of all these transmissions that you've received, and therefore to appreciate basically the level of inequality that we want to correct, we need to have a system that is based on that summed cumulated flow of inheritances received. So that's one, that's a very natural way of thinking about the type of redistribution that we want through these inheritance tax system. The second thing is that there are massive loopholes historically in inheritance taxes. We know, for instance, the famous step-up basis loophole, but there are a lot of exemptions for business assets and stuff like this. And these are very common across all developed nations, and we really need to take a very comprehensive approach about closing them rather than a case-by-case basis. I think right now we're at the level where the overall tax base is just so full of exemption that we need to start by closing across the board all these tax loopholes and really think about what are the ones that really make sense. Okay, so that's two. The third thing is to have a proper understanding of what we want out of inheritance taxation. And I think what's clear is that inheritance taxation is a great way to address, again, unequal opportunities due to the family that you're born in. And in that respect, it seems kind of natural to want to link the type of tax revenues that you create through inheritance taxation with some form of capital endowment for everyone. Why do we know that these capital endowments are useful? Well, because we know that very early on, wealth effects to a lot of very important early investments in human capital, but also in terms of housing, in terms of entrepreneurship, are very affected by the amount of liquidity that you have. And therefore, having these capital endowments early on can really address a set of liquidity constraints that prevent people from making optimal choices in that respect. The last thing, and that comes back to what I was saying, these inheritance tax systems, they've been around for a very long time. But what's very surprising is that today, the level and the quality of information that we have about inheritances and the taxes that are paid on them is actually much worse than what it was even 50 years ago. And so what we need, of course, to convince people about the urgency of doing these reforms, but also about, you know, what you can do reforming the tax base in specific ways or giving these capital endowments. So we need a better information system. And I think really putting resources aside to fund a real investment in the capacities of tax administration to create this information system, I think, is also key.
So you mentioned and emphasized the importance of an information system. Could you talk about what implementing these four principles would perhaps look like in practice?
So in practice, what we've done in the context of France is to get a sense of how, when you have this kind of comprehensive approach to tax reform, that would change the overall shape of the type of the overall amount of taxes that would be paid on inheritances, and therefore how it would change the overall allocation of wealth across individuals. I think that's important because at the same time, doing these type of exercises gives you at the same time a good idea of just how unequal those opportunities are, and also how unradical, so to speak, those very basic reforms that we are proposing are. So the first thing that you would see is that there is a massive amount of inequality in the net accumulated flows of inheritances received by individuals within the same cohort. Okay, so what you see today, and this is taken from France, but I very much expect that these type of figures are the same in many similar countries at the same level of development. So you take a cohort, okay, 50% of individuals within that cohort will essentially receive zero, okay, zero wealth from their parents, zero net wealth, okay, and then you start having 50% of the population that receives a little bit. But before you get to, let's say, the top 10%, the amount that people receive is absolutely negligible, especially negligible compared to the flow of resources that they're just going to generate over their lifetime through their earnings, okay? So the moment we start to talk about, you know, significant amount of money is really in that top 10%. But what's really interesting is then how skewed that distribution of flow inheritances are. Okay, if you take the 0.1% of a cohort, okay, these guys are going to receive on average 13 million euros, okay, net of tax, okay, and just, you know, from the simple fact of being born, okay. So you see the discrepancy between people who receive 13 million net of tax, okay, and 50% of the population that receives zero. This is much, much, much more unequally distributed than earnings, for instance, okay? So really, inherited wealth is the most unequal set of resources in terms of its distribution that you can think, economically speaking. The second thing that you would see doing these type of exercises is that today, the tax system as they work are actually totally failing. Okay, they claim to be extremely redistributive with relatively high marginal tax rate on those large inheritances that we talked about. But actually, because of all these tax loopholes and the fact that they don't tax the cumulative flow of inheritances, actually the effective taxes that are paid by the top 0.1% of individuals that receive 13 million net of tax, their net of tax rate, their tax rate that they are paying is roughly 10% only. Okay. So what you would then see is that if you would just tweak a little bit the tax system by closing a lot of these loopholes, you would get something that is just a little bit more progressive, okay, and that would allow you to fund a very small endowment for a very large fraction of the population, okay. So yeah, that's the type of things that that we do in the context of France, and I believe that, you know, having better information system would help us do the same type of exercises in other countries like the UK, for instance.
Great, thank you so much. And those are some really shocking statistics about the cumulative inheritance flow. Do you view your proposal of redistributing generated tax revenues as a wealth endowment for all as a potential complement or substitute to a universal basic income?
So that's a great point, great question as well. There is a lot of excitement and talk about UBI, Universal Basic Income. I think it's really important to understand that capital endowment for everyone can, of course, never substitute for what a UBI would be doing. Why? Well, it's actually extremely simple. In our modern societies, okay, there is no way to fund lifetime consumption out of wealth for everyone. Okay, why? Well, because if you take the total stock of wealth, the total stock of wealth is roughly, let's say, 6 years of GDP. Okay, but we don't live 6 years, we live, you know, 80, 85 years. So clearly, even if we were to take today all the wealth and stop working, we would only be able to fund 6 years of life. And in general, yes, we cannot fund overall consumption for people who, for some reason, have a handicap or have a bad shock in their life that prevents them from earnings just out of an initial capital endowment. The levels of endowment that you would need for everyone to make sure that they're insured throughout their lifetime against the fact of losing any form of earnings, it would be too much, okay? So what you need is something that really insures people in case they really fall below poverty line because of loss of income, loss of jobs, health shocks, and so on and so forth. And that only the UBI can do. The capital endowment, what it can do is to help all those individuals, the 50% of the cohort that don't receive anything, that can help them make the sound investments early on that they might fail to do because of liquidity and credit constraints. And that's really important because, you know, the early choices you make in terms of where to go to school, where to buy a house, whether or not to set up a business and become an entrepreneur, we know that these margins are extremely affected by wealth and liquidity, and that there might be some frictions with some people being prevented from doing these optimal choices. And this is what the capital endowment can do. But it can never substitute for the UBI, whose mission is a bit different. Again, it's really an insurance against the fact of being exposed to very, very bad shock in your life.
Fantastic, thank you so much. And speaking sort of very generally, inheritance tax is often, I guess, categorized as an unpopular concept. Why do you think this is perhaps the case, and how do you think public opinion could be swayed in favor of policies that you believe could be influential?
So that's also a very important question. So clearly, I think we should not bury our hand in the sand and pretend that inheritance taxes, there is no issue of people disliking them. It's very clear in polls and surveys that people dislike them. Clearly, part of it is due to misinformation and the fact that, again, like I said, there is just such a lack of data that a lot of people are a little bit anxious and believe that they are going to be paying very high taxes when actually they are going to be paying none. So clearly there is, you know, an informational gap that needs to be closed by having better informational system. That being said, that doesn't take away the fact that I continue to believe that inheritance tax alone cannot do the heavy lifting. I think people tend to prefer taxes on the stock of wealth than taxes at the moment of receiving an inheritance, because there is also the timing. This is oftentimes when you lose a relative. It's not, you know, a moment where it's great to talk about taxes. That being said, you know, we know that a tax on the stock of wealth could achieve partly the same goals as inheritance taxation, and they are much more popular than inheritance taxes. So in that sense, I believe that, yeah, the right combo is, of course, going to be some form of inheritance taxation and of taxation on the stock of wealth.
That makes a lot of sense, thank you. So now we'll shift to a different topic, talk about short-time work versus unemployment insurance. So during the pandemic, the US focused its labor market policy response on unemployment insurance, while in Europe, the emphasis was on preserving the relationship between workers and firms through shorter term work schemes. What are the potential benefits and drawbacks of each approach, and how may the two differing policy choices have impacted labor market dynamics and pandemic recovery?
So again, great question. So indeed, when you look at what happened during the pandemic, there are essentially two polar models, the continental European one and the US one. What was the US one? To say, well, you know, let firms lay off people if, you know, these guys cannot work because we're in lockdown. But then we'll make sure that these unemployed receive a high level of unemployment benefits. The continental European approach has been to say, look, these guys cannot work, but in some sense, nothing makes us believe that the moment we're out of lockdown, these jobs are not productive anymore. So then we should just make sure that the individuals keep their jobs, so to speak, and then we're just going to insure the job matches by providing money for reducing your number of hours, and that's what we call short-time work policies. Okay. The main difference is what? In the US, the jobs are lost, okay? What that means is that, of course, when lockdown is over, these people need to get back to jobs. Of course, they could go back to the exact same jobs in practice. And that's the reason why a lot of commentators in the US said that, you know, the difference between short-time work and UI was more a difference of degree rather than nature, Okay, but I think it does matter. Why? Well, because once you are laid off and receive a very high level of unemployment benefits, okay, during lockdown, and then lockdown is over, well, you might actually think, I don't want to get back to that job that I had. I want to search for something else, okay? So whereas in Europe, people essentially went back to the same jobs, in the US, some people started to search for other jobs. And what that creates is a slightly slower reallocation and a slightly slower pace of recovery in the US. But at the same time, a lot of people in the US said, well, but you see, one of the reasons why it's still better to do this is that in the continental European model, you've essentially preserved a lot of job matches, but maybe those job matches are no longer viable after lockdown, okay? And that's the view that basically a lot of the job matches that are preserved by short-time work are actually job matches that, you know, should in any case be destroyed. So the main way to think about what's the optimal strategy depends on this. It depends on whether you believe that the shock that you're facing, it's permanent or it's temporary, okay? And whether the shock is very asymmetric, okay? Eating certain firms differently than others. Why? Again, because if it's a permanent shock, then of course you can preserve today some of these matches, but at the end of the day, they are going to need to be severed. So you're just essentially delaying some reallocation that's going to happen. If the shock is very transitory, then it's a good thing to preserve those matches because they are viable. It's just that for a short period of time, there is a shock, and therefore those jobs are not useful, but they are gonna be useful in the future. So having, you know, people having to search again for a job is extremely costly. So I think what we've tried to write down in that little paper with my colleagues, Julia Giuponi and Alice Lapert is very much, yeah, this simple intuition that what you care about is, you know, the nature of the shock, whether it's asymmetric or not, and whether it's temporary or permanent, and that determines a lot whether you want to use short-time work or UI.
Great, thank you. And in hindsight, is it possible to say whether either region made the right decision, or is it still too early on in recovery? And what are some important lessons that can be learned for the design of future crises responses?
So, in hindsight, what I would say is that the continental European strategy was probably a sound one. It kind of worked relatively well, and it prevented an upshoot of labor market tightness just during recovery. Okay, that's very clear. We really see it in the data. Now, of course, the stark increase in labor market tightness we saw everywhere. We saw it, you know, much larger for the US. That might have to do with this kind of choice of UI versus short-time work. It also had to do with the size of the overall recovery package as well. But yeah, I think at the end of the day, continental Europe did relatively well. But what it really teaches us at the end of the day is that having both programs in place is actually very useful, because you never know what the next recession is gonna look like. And like I said, both instruments are potentially useful. It depends on the type of shock. And therefore, making sure that you have in place those programs and then you can activate them, and, you know, one or the other, depending on the nature of the shock, I think it's definitely useful.
Thank you so much. And finally, a question we ask all economists on our podcast: what gives you hope?
Well, everything gives me hope. You cannot do the type of work we do as researchers without, you know, being hopeful and optimistic. I'm a born optimistic. The reason is it's very hard to bang your head, to be curious about things that are not obvious, if, you know, when you try to go for a solution and it doesn't work, you just stop. You have to be optimistic that something's going to work. And I think that's something that I carry with me in my, you know, daily life as well. I am often extremely horrified by the type of stuff that I find in my own research or by reading newspapers and stuff like that. But I have a sense that, you know, if I can share the journey that we do as researchers with the next generation, with the students, they too can become as excited and curious about finding solutions. And yeah, this is what we strive for at the LSE, right? To we're hopeful that the next generation is going to be as excited as we are to know the causes of things.
Thank you so much. And thank you for those words of motivation and for appearing on this season of the Beverage Report.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Beverage Report podcast, interviewing our very own Professor Camille Londe of the LSE. To access more Professor Londe's publications and research, please visit www.lse.ac.uk/economics/people/faculty/Camille-Londe, where you can navigate to his personal website. To find out more about the child penalty discussed in this episode, visit childpenaltyatlas.org. And if you found this episode interesting, please tune in to our other episodes on Spotify or on our website. To be notified when we upload a new episode, follow us on Instagram at Beverage Report. And if you have any suggestions or feedback for us, please reach out over email to a.kaur8@lse.ac.uk. Until next time, thank you and goodbye.